the Arthropod. The Arthropod is the home for the wonderful, weird, wacky world of insects. Hosted by Jonathan Larson, Jody Green, and Michael Scavarla.
Welcome back, everybody, to Arthropod, your entomology podcast. I am one of your hosts for today, Jonathan Larson of the University of Kentucky. I'm going to be riding solo here. All my other co-hosts are off doing things, getting ready for ESA. But I am joined in a makeshift studio by a fellow professor at the University of Kentucky. Can you introduce yourself?
Hi, yes, I'm Claire Richoff, assistant professor in entomology here.
Thank you for joining me. I'm very excited to get to chat with you here today. I think it's going to be a really fun episode that people are going to enjoy. I hope everybody listening enjoyed our last episode, which was a little silly. It was about a giant insect movie. We talked about Them. Have you ever seen it?
No.
No? It's got giant ants in it in the New Mexico desert, and they steal people and try and hold them up in their colony. It's from like the middle 50s, I think. So it's got all of the tropes and things that you can imagine in your head. I think it's the first one where there's like an old man entomologist and a woman entomologist that show up together, and nobody can believe that she's into bugs. Right. So that trope has been
the first time that happened.
Yes, exactly. In film. We're very excited to be going to the Entomology Society of America meeting. Arthropod will be there. We're going to be bringing the equipment. So be sure to look out for Jody or Mike or myself and say, hey. We're going to have the equipment set up at different intervals if you'd like to get interviewed and talk about your research or just share how much you're enjoying the meeting. We're also going to do little wrap-ups at the end of the day to talk about what we're thinking about what we've seen and the cool science that we've encountered. If you'd like to see any of our presentations, Jody is going to be speaking on Sunday at 2:05 p.m. in room 240. She's going to be talking about being a parent and being a professional. Sounds like a really cool talk. To me, it's part of one of the main symposia for the meeting. I'm also talking on Sunday, but I'm in the morning at 8:35 in room 260, and I'm talking about being a county extension entomologist. It was when I used to have that job, was when I agreed to do that. And then Mike's going to be talking Tuesday at 7:40 p.m. I did not know the meeting extended that late, but he's going to be talking about a deer kid survey that he's a part of and the parasites that they're discovering. Are you going to be doing anything at ESA?
I will not.
No.
I'm teaching my new course this semester.
So what's your class called?
Bees and People.
Bees and People. What's it about?
Yeah, this is it's a course designed for non-science majors to introduce them to the many ways that bees affect human lives and agriculture. We talk a lot about honeybee behavior, social behavior, and all the things we've learned from bees over the years.
Cool. Is your lab going to be represented, though, at ESA? You sending anybody?
Nope, we don't have anyone this year. Cool. Yeah, it's a little unusual. I think we've gone every year for many years. But
next year you can go to Orlando pretty cheap, right? It's a direct flight from here.
Oh, is it?
I think so.
Okay, yeah. We were in Orlando a couple years ago, too, so... Mm-hmm. A repeat appearance there.
Get everybody down there cheap from Kentucky.
Yeah, right.
It's really a delight to get to interview you today. I've been interested in talking more with you about your research since I was preparing for my interview here at University of Kentucky. I went through everybody's websites and was trying to familiarize myself with folks. And I thought yours was a really cool website. It had a lot of really interesting information on it, and I was really intrigued by your research. And then recently you gave your four-year seminar to the department, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when you were speaking, it was just like, this is amazing, really cool stuff. And I wanted to share it with everybody that listens to Arthropod. So kind of with that, like, what have the last few years been like here at UK for you?
That's a big question. I guess, I can talk about the research dimension.
Yeah.
So, you know, my central research passion is behavior. I've studied that for many years in a lot of different species. Most recently in honeybees, which of course are a great example of complex social behavior, behaviors that are impacted by the environment and social interactions throughout life. And so understanding how organisms like the honeybee function is a basic puzzle in biology and one of my central interests. And over the last few years, I've integrated that interest with honeybee health studies, mostly because this is such a critical issue in the world of honeybee biology at the moment and pollinator biology more generally, and sort of unavoidable at this point. And one kind of interesting thing that happened over time trying to merge these two sides of the equation of social behavior and health is I realized that they're actually really strongly linked to each other. And so a lot of the work that I've been doing recently and that I talked about in my recent seminar is related to this intersection between behavior and health, specifically how a behavior like aggression in the honeybee, which is a social behavior, it's socially modulated, it's a collective behavior, that it can actually predict health resilience and tell us something about the health status of an individual.
So that's been a big focus for you here the last 4 years, is that kind of research?
Yeah.
Okay. Exactly. Has it kind of flown by the 4 years that you've worked here?
Yes.
Were you surprised like when they said, hey, you got to do a 4-year seminar?
I wasn't surprised.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it does go by really fast. And every year and semester has been different. Uh-huh. So adjusting to the new job has been just a kind of constant process. I think that's the one thing that's been really surprising. It's, you know, one of the reasons I think a lot of people get into research science is that sort of every day is full of surprises.
Right.
And, you know, you can kind of reach your limit on that at some point. But that's definitely true in the context of being a professor as well.
So before you were a professor, where were you at? What were you doing?
So I was a postdoc for almost 5 years, spread across. I was at Penn State University for a few years and at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign before that. And so during that time, I worked a lot on social behavior, neuroscience, e-health questions, and genomics generally.
Okay. And then for your graduate work, where did you go?
I was at the University of Florida in Gainesville.
Hey, you've hit all the big ones up.
Yes, a lot of large sports schools.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Are you a fan of sports?
Yes. Yeah. I guess the judicious answer to that question. Yeah, it's, you know, it's an interesting experience, combination of issues. And, of course, if you're in an ag college, you're always near the football stadium, so you often have more exposure than other people on campus.
That seems fair.
Yeah, so, right, I've been on a lot of large campuses, and that's interesting. You know, you get access to a lot of really cool researchers that way, so.
Were you working on bees the whole time, or was that just your postdoctoral work, or?
Mostly my postdoc work. So my PhD work was on a large web-building spider.
Oh.
I'm happy to talk about that.
I love spiders. That would be interesting. What spider were you working with?
It's called Nephila clavipes. Some people call it the golden silk spider because it creates this yellow, very conspicuous yellow silk web. It's actually the strongest silk created by any spider in the world. So it's very, very interesting spider. In Florida, they call it the banana spider because it's yellow.
Does it taste like a banana if you lick it?
Maybe. We can't rule that out.
It wasn't part of your study.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So what were you working on with this large, impressive spider?
Yeah, so there, that was sort of more of a behavioral ecology focus. So trying to understand, you know, how behaviors are adaptive and we were studying male reproductive strategies in those spiders and then how those different reproductive strategies impacted body size evolution. Yeah, so there's some empirical work where we're, you know, staging matings and studying males in the field and then some modeling work to try to understand how males get around the complex world that they live in.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And what were some of the findings of this?
Oh, let me think back.
That's kind of probably some spelunking there.
Yeah. Well, there were some interesting things that are kind of notable. So, for example, males in this species actually have a finite amount of sperm, which is unusual for males. Usually sperm is cheap and you can create a lot of it, and that impacts reproductive decisions. But these males, they actually have a limited quantity and their testes actually degenerate as they age during adulthood.
Okay.
So they have a very limited amount to work with. There were other interesting things too. So, males pick different types of females depending on where the female is in her reproductive cycle, and there are pros and cons to each of those choices.
Okay.
And so sometimes people kind of approach something like an insect or a spider as if it has a very basic kind of reproductive strategy. They seek out one type of individual, and that's who they prioritize or prefer. But we actually see that that decision-making process is really variable depending on environmental conditions. Yeah, so they're a little more sophisticated than we give them credit for. And that's sort of how I got back into the honeybee world, because I got really interested in understanding how the brain is processing all of this information.
Right.
And so that's where we got into honeybees to begin with.
So a lot of behavior, a lot of brain science. Are you kind of a neurologist or?
No. The evidence points towards no.
Okay.
No, I do like to take a very kind of broadly comparative approach to biology, just because I don't know. I think we can pick up a lot of information from the way different disciplines view a problem. So, you know, in some ways, we use information from how humans behave socially to inform some of our questions on bees. And sometimes due to the like large body of research on vertebrate neuroscience, we will apply some of those principles back to the insects to try to understand how their brains work. And so I guess I have a general interest in understanding how the environment impacts behavior, and that's very broad. But yeah, I think in my heart of hearts, I'm a behaviorist.
Okay. Is there something that inspired this pursuit, this research pursuit that you have, or was it something you got into as an undergrad, or how did that happen?
The focus on behavior?
So
the behavior focus, yes. I mean, when I learned that you could... that some people are able to predict how an animal will behave, I just thought that sounded like witchcraft.
That's
fascinating, right? Like, you know, how can you possibly do that? And so that's the behavior side of things. And then the other part of this is how the environment impacts behavior, as opposed to, say, just your genes, you know, so we're not sort of determined by our DNA. And that particular angle was interesting to me because of my experience with insects where, you know, just depending on what you eat during development, you might come out a different size, a different shape with a whole different suite of behavioral characteristics. And so they're a set of animals that's very sensitive to the environment. And so that was a really interesting component to me.
Yeah, I like that you describe it as witchcraft.
Sorcery.
Sorcery. I think that might be the subtitle for this episode. Insect Neurosorcerer. So did you work with vertebrates at any point or?
I have in a comparative sense.
Okay.
So, while I was a postdoc, we did, a comparative study looking at the genes that are activated by social interactions in the brain. And we found that some of the same genes are active if you measure a fish or a mouse or a honeybee. They actually share some of the same genes in different social contexts.
Wow.
Which is really interesting.
It is.
Yeah, and I did some work with a sociologist there at University of Illinois, too, studying humans.
Okay.
And how neighborhood violence impacts health and mental health. So that was kind of an interesting leap into another area of biology. Yeah.
Wow, yeah, I would never have guessed that. So would you say that the vertebrate, I mean, if you talk to some of your colleagues that do work with vertebrates, are they more easily predicted than insects? Are insects more variable? Or
this raises, I think, some interesting questions.
Okay.
So, you know, a lot of people that study behavior in neuroscience in vertebrates are studying lab animals, for one thing.
Okay.
And so... this question of variation and sources of variation can be hard to interpret. So honeybee, of course, we're forced to study them in the field. They don't live long-term in the lab. And so that's a bit of a disconnect there. But yeah, I think people over the years have moved away from thinking insects were just kind of instinctive machines that react to cues to realizing that they actually integrate information very similarly to vertebrates.
Okay.
Yeah.
And are honeybees really the best example of that, or is that why you work with them?
In insects?
Yeah.
That's an interesting question. Honeybees are special in the sense that I think people recognize their behavioral complexity. So people have been fascinated for, you know, thousands of years with honeybees and how their societies are organized and how it actually works. We know that the queen is not a dictator in the colony, that somehow it's self-organized. And so I think what makes them special is the sort of recognition of that value in this insect and the fact that people have tried to study it. So there are a lot of good tools available in the honeybee. You know a fair amount about their brain and their genome. And then also just the huge amount of behavioral data and behavioral insights that people have found over the years.
Cool. So it sounds like that's kind of why you ended up with this as your model insect for your lab.
Yeah, it was sort of serendipitous. I kind of say that when you're studying behavior in insects, all roads lead back to the honeybee.
I can see that.
Yeah, I actually started studying honeybees as an undergraduate for an honors project. I was working on the cues that induce swarming behavior, which is, you know, of course, the behavior that honeybees use when the colony's reproducing. And so I started out with honeybees. I got super fascinated with spiders because they are very strange for some reasons I described. So if you're interested in the evolution of behavior, they're really cool for that.
Okay.
But then wanting to go back into the brain and, you know, especially understand genome dynamics, honeybee is a kind of one of the most well-studied animals in that area.
Okay. Do you have your own colonies that you keep for the lab now?
We do. Yeah. Right. So we keep most of our own hives. We also rent hives from other beekeepers, depending on the project and what we need. So we have some on campus. Most of them are on our research farms.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Do they have names? Do you name every bee?
No. When I was in grad school, I used to name my spiders.
Yeah?
And I took a little bit of help for that. So I stopped doing it.
Uh-huh.
We don't name the bees. I don't know. It's,
be a lot of names.
Yeah, it's a lot. You know, 40,000 a hive or so.
Yeah, name the queen, maybe.
Yeah.
Then you can have like a coronation process, perhaps even.
Yeah. Most beekeepers will tell you, don't become emotionally attached to your bees.
It's a tough process
at this point.
I met some beekeepers in Nebraska when I was out there. And I think one lady that I talked to, she went through 7 hives over 4 years or something like that, just losing them. And so, yeah, I don't think that it's something you should pour your heart too much into. It doesn't sound like.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're working with the bees. You got a bee suit and everything?
Yep.
Yeah.
Several bee suits. Yeah.
Do they work for you?
Pretty well. Yeah. You know, nothing's perfect, but.
Nothing is perfect.
Yeah.
I remember getting attacked by bumblebees as a grad student. That was always a lot of fun. It's a little different than a honeybee, I guess, but.
Yeah. In good and bad ways.
Yeah. They can get you more.
Yeah.
There are fewer of them to attack you, I suppose.
Yeah.
Have you had a lot of sting events?
Yes. Yeah. So, yeah, it's kind of it's kind of unavoidable, and depending on what we're doing, we get stung more or less. One year I counted how many times I was stung in a summer, and it was something like 87 times. But that's a lot for, you know, just as a number, but over 3 or 4 months, it's kind of, you know, it's not too bad. For the most part, you know, we sort of managing bee safety is a huge part of the lab, and that's been something I've had to learn to do as a professor too, is make sure everyone's safe in the hives, and so that's always a challenge that we're thinking about.
So I find that angle interesting, since you mentioned now that you study aggression, it seems like you are probably inducing some of the sting behavior.
Oh yes.
Okay.
In unpredictable ways. When I started my postdoc, I knew I was going to be doing something with aggression, but I hadn't really thought it through. Somewhere in the middle of the first summer, I was like, oh, okay, yeah, I guess this, maybe I should have seen this coming.
This is the logical endpoint.
But I like to think that after me going through that kind of, you know, literal growing pains, that I'm protecting some people from that same experience.
But, I like that. That's a very healthy way to look at it.
It's sort of maybe idealistic, but.
I think it's the way to think of it. So what is aggression then? Like, we kind of hinted around it and talked about getting stung, but what is aggression when it comes to a honeybee? I can think of it when I think of like my dad driving down the road, but is it a very different sort of scenario for these insects?
Yeah. So, coming from behavioral ecology, you know, we look at behaviors broadly across species and look for commonalities. And so, you know, aggression is one of these behaviors that manifests to some degree in some way in most animals. And you just gave an example of driving in humans. And honeybees, we study a couple very specific contexts for aggression. So most of the aggression work we do is with worker honeybees. So the 40-some-odd thousand bees that make up the hive, other than the queen. They're all females, by the way. The workers defend the nest against different types of predators. Some are large mammal predators, like a bear or a raccoon or a skunk or something. And others are things like wasps or other honeybees that might try to get in and steal food. Those are actually two very different contexts for aggression. If you want to get rid of a big bear or something like that, you need hundreds or thousands of helpers. And so in those contexts, aggression is kind of like a schooling behavior in fish. It's a collective behavior, which is a kind of special type of social behavior. And then defending against smaller predators, you need a different strategy, of course. So that's most of what we study in terms of aggression. It's nest defense in these different contexts. But the queen can also be aggressive in a hive, and she also has a stinger. It's very different from a worker bee stinger. Worker bees have this barbed stinger that they lose. It gets ripped out of their body when they sting, and so they die. The queen doesn't have the barbs, so she can sting over and over again without any mortality. And queens are typically aggressive towards other queens in very specific situations, like when there's a new queen being reared by the workers in the hive. It's usually more than one. And so, you know, the queens have to duel for control of the colony.
Regicide.
Yeah. Yes.
That's
there
the
you
way
go.
To do it. So there are some different endpoints even with this aggression then, right? Because if you're attacking a bear, you are going to sting it. But a wasp, in those, like, do they always sting a wasp or another honeybee? Or do they sometimes do the heat them up and bake them kind of thing? Or
yeah, so a couple interesting points there. So that behavior you're talking about, the wasp falling behavior, is performed by some species of honeybee, but not the one we have here in the U.S. So that's a bit different. But the degree of aggressive response does depend on the predator threat. So, you know, I think I was telling someone this story recently at some point. You know, I was really curious. We quantify these very low-level kind of threatening behaviors, and we are always debating with each other whether that's truly an aggressive behavior versus something like stinging, which is, like, obviously aggression. And so I was out in the bee yard, and I just took some honeybees from different hives and shoved them in the entrances of different hives to see how the bees responded. And mostly they give them very low-level defensive behaviors. They kind of are threatening. They get rid of them as opposed to killing them at the sacrifice of their own workers. But then I found a paper wasp nest that had fallen to the ground and still had some wasps on it. So I grabbed one of those, put it in, and very different response, much more extreme, much more aggressive response. So they do modulate that activity. But of course, there are costs to staying for honeybee.
For sure. Yeah. And probably expensive to make the venom and everything as well for them energetically, right?
Yeah. I don't know a lot about the venom synthesis process. They all have, workers differ with age in terms of how responsive they are to aggressive cues. So older bees typically are more responsive. And those are bees that are, primed for foraging and have kind of the flight capabilities of an older bee. I suspect they also have some of the other features that make for a successful aggressive response, like having venom and that kind of thing at higher levels. But I actually don't know about that. You can pretty much be stung by any worker bee of any age.
Right.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. I've always been kind of fascinated, too, because it kind of feeds back into what you said before about thinking of insects as very machine-like, because when I've heard people talk about aggression in bees or defensive response, I always hear them talk about the pheromone that's released when you get stung, this alarm pheromone that supposedly smells like bananas. Is that accurate?
Yeah, it smells kind of like banana runts or Laffy Taffy.
Okay.
Or like candy banana smells.
The fake banana smell, okay. And that then it kind of elicits this, not colony-wide, but anybody that detects it has been able to sort of follow you or knows that you're the thing that needs to be stung, right? Do they always do that, or can they make a decision to be aggressive in that instance, or is the pheromone really kind of an automatic sort of response?
Yeah, that's a great question. So one of the ways we measure aggression at the colony level is to expose colonies to small amounts of alarm pheromone, the primary component you're talking about. And the response is really varied. You even have some colonies where bees will retreat when they're exposed to alarm pheromone. The presence of a threat induces a sort of defensive or a retreating response as opposed to an active aggressive response. And we've shown that there are a lot of different ways that response can be modulated by the environment. So sometimes if you have, say, repeated predator threats, that can actually make bees more responsive to alarm pheromone. If you really disturb them on a chronic basis, especially if they're small colonies, we found that you can actually decrease their aggressive response. So it's a kind of a releaser of aggressive behavior, but the degree to which they respond on a colony and individual level is very context dependent.
Okay.
It's also dependent on other factors too, like genotype.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And that's like where Africanization and things can come in?
Yeah. So, Africanized bees, this is a problematic term, I think, for, you know, a few reasons. I'm trying to avoid the use of that term just because it sort of has this, it suggests that all honeybees from Africa are unusually aggressive.
Right.
And it has negative connotations. But the pattern that's been established is that hybrid bees, so bees that are in the New World that are hybrids of the sort of traditionally European-derived subspecies with a subspecies that is from Africa, tend to be more aggressive, and they are genetically distinct from the European subspecies that are more commonly managed in the United States, as
right.
I'm sure most of the listeners may know. But honeybees are not native to the U.S. or North America. They're introduced from Europe. So, yes, there is a hybrid of a couple different subspecies that's genetically distinct and more aggressive. Yeah, and interestingly, back to the health issue, resistant to certain parasites and stressors right. as well.
I don't want to belabor, but like, is there a better term I should be using instead of Africanized?
No, I think this is a place where the biologists need to catch up maybe with other things. You know, so Africanized is the accepted term because
right.
it's a hybrid. It represents that hybridization
okay.
as opposed to saying like African
right.
bee. There's a distinction there. That is just that term and the dynamic that was
right.
problematic.
Yeah, I've always kind of wondered about that, but I've never had anybody actually bring it up and say that while we've been discussing it. Because in most contexts, when that comes up, it's killer bees, which
right.
also is like a problematic thing.
Yeah, right.
So interesting. So is this sort of feed into, when I was doing my research for this episode, I found a press release, I think from the U of I, University of Illinois, that featured you talking about, and the title was Wimps or Warriors.
Oh boy, okay.
And it was talking about your work looking at social interactions and how they get under the skin of the bees and cause these changes. So you talked about a defensive response that's kind of a retreat, a defensive response that's kind of to attack.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what that press release was about, that paper was about, or am I misunderstanding what the U of I was trying to say there?
Yeah, I actually would have to go back and see which study that was talking about. I can think of a few, but the general concept relates to a lot of our studies, which is just trying to understand, you know, why is it that when you have a social interaction, it causes a change in behavior that might persist for a really long time, or it may not. So, you know, to put in kind of a human analogy, some people that experience something like early life social trauma, and that might impact their health and behavior throughout their entire lives. It seems almost irreversible. But then you have other social interactions that happen today, you'll forget about tomorrow.
Right.
And so what we're interested in is trying to understand how it is that social information changes behavior. And sort of by definition, it must be doing something to the brain. And so we've looked at a few different, characteristics of the organism that change with the social interaction. And for example, we see a lot of differences in the way that genes are operating in the brain. We also see differences in how genes are operating in other tissues as well, which is interesting. You might not think about something like the liver controlling behavior,
right.
But it's correlated with those changes. So we have a recent study where we found that developmental environment in bees impacts aggression. That might have been what that was referring to.
I think it had something to do with taking larvae out of one hive and mm-hmm. putting them in another and then switching them back when they reached adulthood.
Yeah, so we took a queen and we forced her to lay eggs in a piece of honeycomb, and then we took those bees and divided them into either a high or a low aggression colony.
Right.
So they're siblings, but they had different developmental experiences. And then we pulled them out of those hives just prior to adulthood, so we could time their emergence just by counting the days
right.
since they've been laid. And we had them emerge in the lab, kept them in that common lab environment, so they're no longer experiencing social information from the hive. And we found that just that developmental experience predicts differences in behavior. So, yeah, so bees that grew up in a high aggression colony were more aggressive as adults. And in fact, this gene expression data I was just talking about is a follow-up of that, where we sequenced those bees. We looked at their brain, but also tissues that are associated with immune response and response to pesticides, since we've also found that those high-aggression bees were more pesticide-resilient. And there we do see signatures of that environment in all of those tissues.
That was actually one thing I remember from your seminar that I found really fascinating is, so I did ecotoxicology stuff as a grad student, bumblebee response to pesticide exposure, things like that. And I remember people asking questions a lot. Whenever people talk about bees, they always talk about honeybees first, right? That's kind of the poster child. So they would ask questions about, well, how can we rear bees to be more resistant to pesticides, or are there ways that we can make them more resilient so that we can continue to use these tools? That the people that I talked to that were working in the field, at least, that seemed to be something that they would bring up several times. So are findings like yours going to help change those practices and maybe introduce new, for lack of a term, stock into the colony so that we can breed? They might be slightly more aggressive, it sounds like, but they're going to be better prepared to deal with the world that they live in?
Yeah, another great and complicated question. So, yeah.
If you can answer it in 30 seconds.
Right. The quicker the better. Yeah, no easy answers. So the pesticide issue you bring up is an interesting one. So we find, you know, these high-aggression bees, as a function of their developmental environment, were more resilient to pesticides. We don't know what it is about the developmental environment that's leading to that effect. So, for example, high-aggression colonies tend to have higher levels of foraging activity. At least our data show that. And so they may be better at collecting food or have better access to floral resources. So maybe what we're seeing is actually a difference in nutritional stress. That's also something we could change on the environmental level. Then to kind of switch gears and hit another point related to your question, you know, breeding bees that are resistant to certain stressors. There's a lot of work doing that, especially bees resistant to varroa mites, which are these large parasitic mites that are kind of public enemy number one.
Yeah.
And one thing we can control in the bee's environment to a degree. So there's a lot of breeding effort there. And, you know, historically people have bred, against aggression, bred for more docility, for kind of obvious reasons.
Right.
And one kind of lingering knowledge gap we have, as I mentioned, a few times, we study how the environment modulates behavior. And so we've done a lot less work understanding the genetic basis of variation and aggression. And so connecting those two levels. So, you know, the environmental effects we see that change behavior and health. Are they also playing out at the genetic level? How does aggression tie in such that you could maybe breed bees that have these positive health outcomes without aggression? Answering that question is kind of complicated at this point. But as I mentioned before, some of these like hybrid bee species that are more aggressive do show some positive health outcomes, like varroa mite resistance.
Right. So if we can just deal with the aggression and get over ourselves, maybe.
Maybe. Yeah. I always tell people this. So in the study where we did that developmental kind of cross-fostering study, we did measure aggression in a lot of different hives so that we could pick our high and low aggression foster environments. And there we also measured mite levels and found that the more aggressive colonies had fewer varroa mites. And that was all within the sort of European subspecies of honeybees. And those were all easily managed with smoke. So they aren't showing the levels of aggression anywhere near the kind of killer bee hybrid aggressive bees. And so there seems to be a lot of room for improvement that doesn't involve dealing with an insanely high aggression bee. Yeah.
It sounds like you have a lot of research to do in the future. You got a long career ahead of you.
Thank you.
That's good, right?
I hope so. Yeah.
It sounds like it's been a really cool kind of twisty road, starting with spiders and ending up with honeybees, or even starting with honeybees and then ending up back with them again. You'll never be free of them.
Yeah, maybe not.
You should get a honeybee tattoo, probably, if you're into
tattoos. Probably, yeah.
Like maybe on your back, like a whole, like Red Dragon kind of thing.
Yeah, like a wing kind of. Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Or the veil. Yeah, you're secure. You're good to go.
A face tattoo and a veil. I've heard that before.
So we talked a lot about your research. I know that you've also done some other really cool things. In fact, I think you were one of the early science policy fellows for the Entomology Society of America. Can you talk about that experience at all? I know some listeners are interested in maybe joining up with that, or they've heard about it on the fringes, but what exactly is that program and how can people get involved?
Yeah, so this was a two-year fellows program. Basically, the major sort of function of the program, we took two trips a year to Washington, D.C. One trip was specifically meeting on the Hill with staffers for congressional members. And that was really interesting. So just trying to offer ourselves as a resource for all their questions entomological. For example, Zika was a huge issue at that time. Just making sure that they understood that they had a strong resource in the ESA, a lot of experts that they could come to if they had any policy-related questions or biology questions. The other sort of set of meetings we did associated with that, we would meet with other government agencies and nonprofits that are insect-related in some way, trying to understand how they function. How we as scientists contribute to those areas of science policy. And I've since then been on the science policy committee for the ESA as well. So that's been an interesting experience, coordinating position statements on big problems like climate change and the sort of insect relevance of that issue, pollinator health, things like that.
Right.
Yeah. I found it really interesting. General interest in, I think, trying to understand public perception of science and policies around it has always been a fascination of mine. For people who want to get involved, the ESA is a good organization in the sense that there are a lot of opportunities for people at all levels. And I would suggest, even if you want to be involved, say, on the Science Policy Committee, getting involved in some other leadership capacity first may be the stepping stone. So, kind of take the opportunities as they come and kind of weave your way to the areas of interest.
Very cool advice. Yeah. I think that's good for grad students in particular. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of grad students listen to the show while they count bugs under a microscope.
Okay. Yeah.
So yeah, hopefully they were listening to your advice. Is there anything else you'd like to share with everybody that's listening? Do you have any openings in the lab or anything you'd like to advertise?
I have nothing to advertise. anything else I want to share? No, not really.
Okay. Well, I really appreciate you being on the show. I think it was a lot of fun just to hear about your research. It sounds like a really awesome area to be an expert in. And I hope everybody appreciated getting to hear what you've been discovering over the last few years in your lab. And hopefully we'll have you back on in the future. We can hash out some of the things we left open-ended.
Yeah, right. Sounds good.
Yeah, awesome. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah,
and
thank you.
If you all want to find us on the web, we are at arthro-pod.blogspot.com. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at BugmanJohn. Do you have a Twitter that you want people to
call? I do not have a Twitter.
Okay. If you want to find the show in other places, you can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, any of your favorite podcatcher apps. If you want to help support the show, just leave us a review and maybe some stars on those different apps so that we can get out there into the world a little bit more and more people can find us. So thanks for listening, and we'll see you all at ESA here very soon.
It's time for our insect heroes to put away their nets and pheromone traps. Join us next time, same bug channel, as the Arthropod Gang make the world safe from poor insect podcasts. Until then,
keep on bugging.